Today on Backroom Politics, Vladimir Putin, not only does he steal Super Bowl rings, he steals White House thunder. The Obama-Putin meeting that, well, went okay. Also, the G8 meeting in Northern Ireland, we'll talk about that. The evolving immigration fight in Congress continues to get, well, confusing. Obama's sinking poll numbers and tell me a story today on Backroom Politics.
Live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., this is Backroom Politics. To join the discussion, you can call toll-free 1-877-662-3713. And now, the moderator of Backroom Politics, Justin Russell.
You've been on mute. Oh. Wow, we've been on mute. Let's try this again. Hi, everybody. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Thought we'd take us off mute for a second. Let me start off again. To my left, he is the former 8-term member of Congress representing Washington's 2nd Congressional District. He is Congressman Al Swift. Hello, Al.
Hello. You repeat yourself very well.
I know. I didn't even mention the key line shirt you're wearing. Hey, to my 11 o'clock, he is the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald R. Ford. He is the former vice president of government affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Justin. Glad to be here.
To directly across from me in the 12 o'clock position, she is the former House counsel for the Homeland Security Committee. She is the former general counsel for the Maritime Administration, which makes her a Barack Obama appointee. She is the Honorable Denise Krepp. Hi, Denise.
Hi, Justin. How are you doing?
Do the crystals weigh down on your neck like that?
My chandelier necklace.
Good Lord. And to my 1 o'clock, he is the former Undersecretary of Commerce, longtime Senate staffer who has served under at least, at last count, 4 presidents, a very distinguished and charming fellow from the Simpson Center. He is the Honorable Alan Moore. Hi, Alan.
Hello, Justin. I am so glad that we got ourselves off mute because I was thinking about that team of people at NSA who was listening to our every word and thought, they went mute.
They found a way to go through PRISM. Carl Tubin's on his way in, but joining us right now for our first segment, he is our international expert. He is the Vice President of Eurasia Center. He is Dr. Ralph Winnie. Hi, Ralph. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be with everyone.
Okay, let's talk about what's going on in Ireland, because it's bizarre. First of all, I don't even want to talk about the Super Bowl ring. We'll get to that later. But let's talk about what's going on with Obama and Vladimir Putin. It was a very, well, yeah, Bob says nothing.
No.
Bob says nothing, but what's happened is they met. Now, what we do know is that apparently some sort of nuclear non-proliferation, reduction of nuclear war threat treaty or agreement has been agreed to by both parties. However, outside of that, nothing really happened. I'm going to start with you, Ralph Winnie. There were expectations from both sides that at least some of the Syrian situation would be addressed. Fell below both expectations.
Right.
What's your take on what's happening with Putin and Obama regarding Syria?
Well, Putin has maintained that there is no evidence that the Syrian government is using chemical weapons. And he does not want, it's not in Russia's interest to remove Assad, because Assad represents one of the last major allies that the Russians have in the Middle East, especially considering the fact that they control the Mediterranean port in Tartus. So Putin is very adamant about not allowing any kind of foreign intervention into Syria. Now, that being said, he has come on board with this resolution to quote, stop the bloodshed in Syria. And there are 8 components of this resolution, including increasing commitments to humanitarian aid, maximizing diplomatic pressure, backing a transitional governing body for Syria, learning the lessons of Iraq, maintaining Syria's public institutions, working together to rid Syria of terrorists and extremists, and condemn the use of chemical weapons by anyone in Syria and allow for UN probe. Note, it does not mention Syrian President Assad or call him to step down.
I mean, Alan Moore, I mean, there's no question that the ties right now between Moscow and D.C. are not exactly Cold War level, but they're pretty frigid right now. And the relationship between Putin and Obama just is not there. Where do you see might be the disconnect in all this?
Well, I've never seen the connect. So I don't think they had a bond that they were trying to preserve. There was some hope that they would find one, and the president had a much ballyhooed notion of resetting, in computer language, the relationship, and that ended up being a laugh line on Saturday Night Live. It's just tough. They're in a very different place. We have very different systems, and sometimes our interests conflict. And as Ralph said, President Assad's one main friend in the world, and that, you know, in that general part of the world is Russia. Putin's put himself in an interesting position, though. He said, "We're not persuaded by the evidence relating to chemical weapons." Well, does that mean if he becomes to be persuaded, that then that would force him to do something? Meanwhile, President Obama, who talked about the red line vis-a-vis chemical weapons, has obviously considered it a red dotted line for quite a while, but now appears to be ready to move in another $300 million in aid to the rebels. So he is finally stepping out a little farther than he has, and it's not a risk-free move.
And by the way, the switchboard is open right now. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at toll-free 877-662-3713. Again, that number, 877-662-3713, to join the conversation here on Backroom Politics. Congressman Al, the administration has been waffling on Syria for a while. It's been a thorn in their international diplomatic side. Yet, even after this meeting, they still can't get the right message out exactly how the U.S. government should intervene, support the Syrian rebels, or intervene in the Syrian question. What is keeping the White House from being proactive?
Well, I obviously have no idea. You'd have to be in the White House.
It's never stopped us before.
What, pardon?
It's never stopped us before.
Well, it's never stopped me before, but the fact is we don't know. And I suspect there are people in the White House who don't know. But it's a very difficult problem. I think we all agree with that. And the president is a damned if you do, a damned if you don't, damned if you do something else kind of a situation. And he's trying not to do something that will make a mistake. The problem is, if he waits too long, inaction will be the mistake.
But
I don't think any of us here are ready to tell him what he should do about it.
But Denise, we're seeing a lot of pressure from our allies in Europe as far as this is something we've got to get involved in. We've had several of our allies confirm the use of chemical weapons through their intelligence agencies. We've had a couple of heads of state even reach out and say, look, we've got to get involved. This is a tragic situation. Again, the Obama administration can't get out of the way. In your mind, what do you see as might be the Obama?
I don't think it's they can't get out of their way. What I'm betting is happening right now is they're in the planning stages. As you know, Justin, you don't simply just appear in a country. There's a huge logistics chain that has to come with you. I mean, if you want to drop in the 82nd, you want to drop in the 101st, that's fine. You can drop in those boys and girls, but they can only last about 24 or 48 hours without backup supplies. So if we're talking about going in, or even we're talking about providing support, there's more than just coming in. You have to back it up. You have to bring the cargo in. You have to bring the personnel. You have to do a lot of the backroom stuff in order to get the feet on the ground.
But Ralph Winnie, even if we look at even minor intervention through the use of whether it's unmanned aerial vehicles, whether it's the use of our own supply chains, our own logistics support. That's got to be something that's weighing on the mind of Vladimir Putin right now as far as how he's going to deal, not just right now with Barack Obama, but throughout this whole G8 conference.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think that's really what brought him to an agreement on this resolution. If you talk to the Russians, they will say it's better to deal with the devil that you know than the devil that you don't know. And Assad is someone that they feel provides order and stability in this tumultuous region. If we got rid of Assad, who knows what kind of regime would take over.
Denise.
My question, though, is when are we going to come in? Because we're in June right now. If you're going to fight this type of, if you're going to provide additional support, you want to provide it in the summer and into the fall. If we're talking going into the winter, we're talking about additional displaced folks that do not have heat, that do not have supplies, that do not have food, and that is where you do not want to go into a battle in the winter. You want to go in the summertime.
But I mean, humanitarian aside, Alan Moore, we've been in this war now for over a year. They've been having this civil war. At one point, the rebels were seen to have the upper hand. Now it looks like that the Assad regime has taken over some of that overtaken area. This is going to be a back and forth constantly. Is the world community ready to at least step in as collectively and say, look, something's got to give?
There is no consensus around the world about what to do here any more than there is here in the United States. And it's fascinating to watch the president evolve here. And we all remember his knocks on President Bush back in the 2008 elections. And we reflect now on what's happened since. Closed Guantanamo. Oops, it's still open. Don't hold prisoners outside the United States. Oops, we've got a number of them in different places. No big surveillance of Americans. Oops, we've got an even bigger program than we thought. And we're also hearing just this last week in this interview that the president did with Charlie Rose, where he said, until you've sat in the Situation Room of the White House and listened to all sides and all the information, you don't understand how difficult these decisions are. It reminded me of things back in the Vietnam War, from going before Nixon, from LBJ. It's, hey, this is really complicated. Trust us, trust us, trust us. Every president says it. I don't hold it against Obama that he says it, but we've heard it from every president ever. And the only problem with him is he's talked about this great grand transparency, and he was so critical of everything about President George W. Bush. And now he's learning and has learned and is continuing to learn. Oh, my God, this is really hard stuff, really complicated, and it's super hard, given all the secrets involved, to get the public behind an
Congressman
approach.
Al.
Among the people who don't seem to learn that are every candidate who runs for the presidency. You go back to John Kennedy, and we had a missile shortage. It turned out that it wasn't true when he got into the White House. And so challengers will always be talking about some kind of an ideal without much information. And I don't know, can you counsel them to talk more responsibly?
Well,
because your answer is yeah and lose the election.
Alan Moore,
that, precisely. You don't have to behave more responsibly if it brings you success. I mean, it's one of the great tragedies of the system. We've got a population of, shall we be charitable and say, low information voters, and these people speak to the lowest common denominator. They try to keep things super simple in a very complicated world, but they do it because it works.
Ralph,
one of the things that they discussed at the G8 was this idea of a peace conference to be held in Geneva as soon as possible. I think now Obama and Harper should take the lead in putting together this conference and really moving the issue forward, getting people to commit to...
And by Harper, you mean Stephen Harper, the Prime Minister of Canada.
Yes. Because Canada has only agreed to commit humanitarian aid, but not to arm the rebels. So the G8 countries have got to come together and figure out exactly what they're going to do to alleviate the crisis in Syria at this peace conference.
But Bob Hines, when we look at the relationship between, you know, two of, let's call it the three major superpowers, we'll include China in that, but when you're looking at the relationship that Moscow has with Washington, D.C., domestically, that's got to be a little bit unnerving for a lot of the Americans that view this as saying, wait a minute, we thought we were done with this.
You mean done with?
Done with, you know, the Cold War, done with bad relations between Moscow and Washington.
I'm not so sure, Justin, that most Americans ever thought we were good. We have good relationships with the Russians. It's pretty hard, you know. Obviously, we're not, you know, waving nuclear weapons at each other anymore. But you take a look at that government they've got, which is a crypto bunch of hoodlums who are running the place and making
crypto,
it.
Crypto, I like that.
That's a new one. I like that
just
one.
The kind of people who are putting all their money down there in Cyprus in the banks and taking it out of the country, and because who knows what was going to happen, and they're all friends of Putin's, and he is as bad a leader of a country as you can possibly believe, because as far as liberties and freedom of his people are concerned, he's literally a total autocrat in the worst sense of an old czar.
Ralph Winnie.
And this is the interesting dynamic in Russia, is you have a lot of young people have tremendous technocratic skills. They want to work within the system, but they get very frustrated because certain groups of people are profiting and everyone else has to struggle.
Yeah.
At the same time, people remember what it was like after the fall of communism and you had democracy. People's life savings got wiped out when they revalued the currency.
But did we really actually see democracy in a Russia post-Gorbachev?
The Russian view of democracy is Boris Yeltsin and the problems with the currency revaluation and losing their life savings. So they are more willing to adopt an autocratic kind of government like Putin if they're able to make money and to live.
Is there a renewed nationalistic sense in Russia?
I think so, certainly among younger people. And one of the things that upset the Russians was what happened in Libya. After the fall of Gaddafi, Russians really don't have any influence there anymore. I mean, the people are very nationalistic. They don't like other sources coming in and telling them what to do. At the same time, they don't want their government to take advantage of them. So it's kind of an interesting paradox there.
Denise Krepp.
Who is Putin talking to? And the reason I say that is, you know, for the most of us, we have significant others. You know, if you've had a bad day, you're going to go to your wife, your husband, your partner, and say, I've had a really shitty day, and let me tell you why. And your partner...
Family show!
And you're going to be able to talk to somebody. Well, we just heard that Putin and his wife of 30-plus years are divorcing.
Yeah.
So my question is, who is Putin now talking to? Because if it's not his wife, then who's providing him with counsel when he goes home and says, I've had a really bad day?
Well, this brings up a very, very interesting question, Ellen. Or when we look at who Putin is surrounding himself with, he's really never come out of power. I mean, there's a lot of people that say Medvedev, who was the previous president, was just a puppet of Putin behind the scenes. Have we really seen a truly transparent Putin administration that even the Soviets would embrace?
No. There's nothing transparent about his inner circle. The only thing that's transparent to the world is that this guy is got power and he's not going to let it go. And if he finds that there are very wealthy Russians who get crossways with him, then he will put them in jail and basically throw away the key. So he really does exercise autocratic power, as Bob says. But the big problem right now for the public, the Russian public, is they were better off before. The great grand masses at least had food and electricity, a health system that kind of worked. And many of them are today worse off than they were before. And so if it comes to feeling comfortable and safe versus this notion of democracy, which they have never experienced and don't really understand, they will opt for
safety and security rather than democracy. That doesn't mean they wouldn't like to be more expressive. Television, the internet, Western music, movies, this stuff opens up the world to them. But if they don't have food and it's cold and the schools don't work and they're sick and there's no treatments, that trumps everything.
I mean, are we seeing a resurgence maybe, Denise Krepp, of people longing even for the Gorbachev Soviet Union?
Absolutely. I mean, I agree with what Alan just said. When you can say, hey, I've got something in my stomach, then yes, you're going to be happy. If you're thinking about how am I going to be able to feed my kids tomorrow or the day after, I'm really not going to be concerned about democracy. I'm going to be more focused on how do I pay my bills and how do I get my kids fed.
Right. But the problem is the wealth is all concentrated in the hands of individuals.
In the oligarchs.
Yeah. And that makes everything problematic. If you're trying to run a small business, having to be able to navigate through the system. And more younger people are getting frustrated and they're trying to go west and set up operations.
Al Swift.
As we've been talking about Putin in several different ways today, it's reminded me that this guy came from the heart of the KGB. Now, this is not a guy who is likely to want to lead for democracy. He may try to show some lip service to it as he needs to. But in fact, you probably can't find a head of a country that is probably less, in terms of his own views, less democratic than he is.
But Bob Hines, all that considered, right now we've got what amounts to a Mexican standoff in Moscow and here in Washington. Is there somebody that could possibly come out of this looking good in the eyes of the rest of the global community as so-and-so is the bigger man, whether it's Putin or Obama?
No, I don't, you know, the president has done what he can do. Putin basically rejects it. You can't do anything about it. That's it. I mean, that's the relationship. The relationship is, on the one hand, you're way over on the left side, the other hand, you're too far apart. That they can't. They don't have any mutual ground to stand on. They don't have any place to even begin to stand on. They have two totally different views of how to run a country. They have totally different views of what the world interest is. And the Russians are just not going to be helpful.
But, Ralph, when we look at who, going back to the question of who's, you know, talking to Putin,
right.
The same question can be said is who are we talking to? Are we using anybody as intermediaries to deal with Moscow, whether it's London, Ottawa, Paris, Berlin?
I think we've tried to work through the European community. But again, it hasn't been successful. And I think, unfortunately, it comes down to the fact that Putin doesn't respect Obama. And that's very, very disappointing. You can just see it in the body language and their interaction. And what's going to have to happen is it's going to have to be in Putin's best interest, or shown to be in his best interest, to come around on the issue of Syria and the chemical weapons. Right now, he's not willing to budge. He feels the best interest of the Russian people is to keep Assad in power.
Alan Moore, is this a mutual respect deal? Is there a lack of mutual respect between Obama and Putin that could cause a little bit of the tension that we're seeing right now?
Personal relationships matter, but I don't think that's the key to this. I don't think that if these guys had become drinking buddies or played some tennis together or something, or some basketball.
We're not going to see another Reagan-Gorbachev relationship ever again, will we?
They don't have the time or the opportunity to be together, to get to know each other. We don't trust Putin. Just listen to the conversation around the table, which reflects our views. Obama doesn't trust Putin. The White House doesn't trust Putin. And Putin doesn't trust us. It's not that we can't talk to him. We've got senior diplomats. We've got second channels, third channels, fourth channels, direct conversation. They know what we want. We kind of know where they're coming from. We just disagree. And Putin has looked at what's happened in Arab Spring across northern Africa and says, so why do I want to associate myself with another Egypt? That's a god-awful mess. And it looks like Assad is prevailing. Assad has been winning in recent months, and Putin thinks, I think this guy is going to prevail. He's going to hang on. Why do I want to be part of something that totally falls apart? If it totally falls apart, I can blame them, and if Assad comes together, oh my God, I've got an even stronger relationship with him. And the fact that 100,000 people have died and around 3 million people have been displaced is not something that seems to trouble Mr. Putin all that much. And that is a difference, I think, from where he comes from and where these the rest of the Western leaders
are. A little collateral damage.
Yeah. Then he's crept, though. It almost seems that, you know, we've got tensions with Beijing right now. It now seems more evident than ever. There's maybe a third front in Moscow. Does this pose another diplomatic challenge to Foggy Bottom, the State Department, and the administration to keep a collective global community together, especially with the global economy we're dealing with?
Absolutely. You can only spend so much time on each issue. So from their perspective, they're going to want to put one of these issues to bed. And the more issues you put on their plate, the less they're going to be able to focus on it. Not only that, if they'll focus on it, you're not going to be able to resolve it. And the other part of this is, when you talk about resolution, what is the president's priority? I mean, is the priority going to be Russia? Is it going to be Beijing? And are we, you know, switching to the Pacific thrust? Are we going to be focusing on South America? I mean, for him, a lot of this is going to come down to, I want to solve this, but how is this going to impact my legacy? And what is my legacy going to be? And do I care that my legacy is going to be Russia? Or am I going to care that it's really more about China?
Interesting comments. Well, we're going to take a quick break here. When we come up, we've got a caller right now on the line. Caller in the 918 area code. You're on the air with Backroom Politics.
Hey, the gang. It's Dakota Wood.
Dakota Wood! How you doing? It's our friend Dakota Wood, U.S. Marine Corps. How you doing, Colonel? Well, I'll tell you what, we saw you call in. What are your thoughts going on?
I'll tell you, the special operations community in this phase that says you can't surge trust, meaning in the moment of crisis, you can't automatically, magically appear a trusting relationship, knowing who you're working with. You have to build that over time. And what the administration has done is not build the bridges during times pre-crisis, so that when you get to moments like Syria or a summit with Putin or what have you, there's no pre-existing relationship. And so you're going to have the consequences of the results that we're seeing now.
Yeah, but Dakota, I got to ask you, you've been around the whole Russian question for a long time. When we see what's going on between Putin and Obama, let's face it, Washington has had to deal with Putin for, at last count, 16 years of power. It's not like we don't know the devil that we're talking to.
Well, the people who are currently in positions of power have not dealt with Putin for 15 years. They're the new guys on the scene that have been wholly distracted by other issues. So you've got long-time watchers like the great folks in your panel here, and you've got people who have been engaged in the geopolitical scene. But when you have a group that comes into power with a different ideology and they feel it's all personality-based and you've been running on campaign rhetoric, and then you come into the hard reality of the way the world really works, hardball politics, a KGB operative, who only appreciates, strength, never compromising, all that stuff, it's a different game. And this team that's in place has not played this game before.
Wow, that's an interesting take, Dakota. Hey, Dakota, we're up on the break right now. Appreciate you calling in, my friend.
Yeah, it's good talking to you.
We'll have you on soon. Thanks for calling.
You bet.
We're going to go to a break. When we come back, always good to have Dakota call in. He's my friend. Anyway, this is when we come back, we're going to talk a little G8 politics. The Gang of Eight have just finished their meetings over in Northern Ireland. We're going to talk about that and what the big outcomes from that were when we come back. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Back Room. 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
Wow, a little bit of Fats Waller. Lulu back in town. And I tell you, when I am back in town, or when any of my friends are back in town, or heck, when we're living here in town, we usually find ourselves down at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., right across from the National Press Club. Why do we come here? Well, they've got the city's best cigar menu, the most diversified, with some of the best-known brands and some that you might even know, but you might want to give it a try. Everything from Arturo Fuentes down to Zeno. You can go all the way from your $9 little petite girly flavored cigars all the way up to the Opus X Lost City. They have a cigar for everybody. Mild, medium, strong, heavy. However you want to smoke it, it's available here at Shelley's Back Room. Come in, have Bob, Na, or any one of the girls show you what the right cigar might be for your taste that evening. Again, Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. As Bob likes to put it, it is definitely the place to be.
You can tell the mailman not to call. I ain't coming home until the fall. And again, I might not get back home at all. Lulu's back in town, yeah. Ain't coming home until the fall. And then again, I might not get home at all. Lulu's back in town. Oh, that woman's back in town. Oh, my, 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 my.
And we're back here live in Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. And I'm your moderator, Justin Russell. If you want to join the conversation, you can call in. Toll free, 877-662-3713. We're going to talk a little GA economic politics right now. You may have missed it. Didn't get a whole bunch of press, but important nonetheless. The global eight economic powers got together in Northern Ireland over the weekend and talked everything from Syria to economic issues to tax evasion. Right. It was a huge issue if you're in the financial communities. But, Ralph, a little bit of a backstep here. What is the G8?
Okay. It's a group of eight countries that come together to solve economic and political issues. And this year, while Syria dominated the meeting, tax evasion transparency were the themes of the summit. And the leaders agreed to a series of commitments, such as sharing info, and changing the rules to let companies shift their profits across borders.
Well, before we get into that,
okay.
Alan Moore, talk to me a little bit. Why should we be concerned about the G8 getting together? Why should this be on our radar screen?
Well, it's not that often that you have the top seven plus Putin. Russia doesn't really qualify economically to be in this group, and there are countries that say, wait a minute, why is he there, for gosh sakes? But there's a G20 that really makes more sense. But the smaller the group, the greater the focus on particular individuals. They get together once a year. They move around country to country. Last year they were in the U.S. at Camp David. The world just kind of watches. These are the big guns, politically speaking, of the world. And now, what they do, what they say, is something that's of really less interest almost than the People magazine aspects of who's doing what. One of the big stories out of Ireland was that Michelle Obama and the Obama daughters went and had lunch at an Irish pub with U2 lead singer Bono, his wife and children. So that gets visibility kind of beyond the what's going on behind the scenes at the G8. This is not a time for major decisions to be made. Although, 10 years ago this week, President George W. Bush, Bush 43, went to the G8 and said, the United States has just passed a law to provide $15 billion over 5 years to fight HIV/AIDS. What are you guys going to kick in? Today at the State Department, they were celebrating that 10th anniversary. So sometimes there will be a particular subject. Right. Food and nutrition was elevated a couple of years ago. There may be a kind of look at the third world and how are we going to help them. I think the problems of the West and the major developed countries and the economic turndown has forced more inward thinking about economies rather than how are we going to help the little guys. Let's get ourselves stronger, and then there will be more ability to help the others.
Well, Ralph, when Alan brings up a good question, you know, when we look at the global recession that just occurred, having the global eight get together in one spot, always good. Was there a significant economic coalition that came together during this meeting that may have stood out?
Really, while it was tax evasion and transparency, really the Syrian issue kind of predominated. But they did come together to talk about agreed to a proposal where oil, gas, and mining companies have to report what they pay to governments. And there's been all of this talk about increased transparency and accountability to stop companies from shifting offshore their profits and making them more accountable to government.
You know, so Denise, when we look at the tax issue, you know, everybody was bringing up in Northern Ireland the question of tax transparency, tax evasion. You know, everybody starts looking at, for example, Britain. David Cameron took a lot of heat because a lot of the Commonwealth crown components, whether it's Aruba, the Caymans, or throw in Caribbean nation here, fall under his jurisdiction. Yet we have a Delaware. There seems to be a lot of hypocrisy when we talk about who's evading what, and you still have a Swiss government that just voted down in their own lower house. We're not giving out the accounting record, or we're not giving out the financial records of Swiss bank clients. Where does the hypocrisy begin and end?
Well, I think, I mean, he's one of Congressman Allison's favorite phrases, what? There's hypocrisy in the world? No, never. But you also forgot to bring up, you know, some other countries that are becoming much more friendly to those who don't want to be as transparent. I mean, you have the Singapores of the world. You have other countries that are saying, hey, you know what, if you want to give us your money, we won't provide the details. So I'm sure that was also in the back of the mind of folks, you know, like what's going on with Germany and Switzerland and the others, saying, you know, what are the others doing to attract our money?
But it seems, Ellen Moore, that you know, David Cameron was taking some, you know, some minor hits as far as, hey, the Crown needs to crack down on some of this stuff. Is that fair to David Cameron in the UK?
Hey, this is the world of politics. It's not a matter of what's fair and what isn't.
Is this a situation where there's no crying in baseball?
Well, no, there's a lot of crying in baseball, but the macho notion is no crying in baseball. I was just looking here, and I was reminding myself the G8, I think, is Group of Eight, and it stands for, it's the seven, it's the G7, but take Russia aside, and you got the seven largest democracies. But you've got three other countries of the top 11, economically speaking, that aren't there. Brazil and India, and one other one, China, of course. And so it's these Western democracies plus Russia. And but it's got a history now of coming together since the 1970s when the French first drew together, I think it was a G6 at the time.
Right.
So you get momentum behind it, though. It gets some visibility. And sometimes if you can get that much power behind a few ideas, especially if they're not world-changing ideas. This is not the United Nations, and the UN has become highly dysfunctional, so it's a smaller group. Again, the G20 is really a more meaningful group of countries in terms of the broader basis.
Of which India, Brazil, and China are involved.
Absolutely. They're all there, along with a bunch of others. It really is the largest 20.
Rough 20.
One of the issues that came up is the U.S. and the EU are going to enter into negotiations to put together a trade deal. And that's going to be interesting to see how that moves forward and whether it will conflict with the EU and the Canadian deal that's kind of in the works. So that's one of the things that Stephen Harper is very, very concerned about.
Bottom lines, when we talk about the G8 getting together and we look at a tenuous point in the global community, i.e. Syria, is this little fraternity of G8 so exclusionary that we're not really getting the full sense of what the global community really should get involved in, or a bad way to get a minor alliance together?
Well, obviously, you're talking about the G8 is major economic countries. They are, but the G20, as Alan said, have much more authority because it pulls in a larger group. And you know, we have a smaller group as the G8 is. I cannot see them having any influence at all as a group, just that group, on dealing with the Syrian situation. You have a broader base.
When I was there in 2011, the major issue was, of course, the Arab Spring, and what could the EU do to help these burgeoning democratic movements that were occurring in the Middle East. And there was a commitment to provide financing and training to help these young activists to try and achieve the next level. But it doesn't seem like any of that really materialized down the line.
But Alan Moore, everything going on, is the G8 now becoming obsolete, or is this something that's critical to our foreign policy and the foreign policy of our partners?
It's neither one. It's not obsolete. It's got a history. It gives everybody a chance to focus what should be on our agenda, where can we find something that we can produce, that we can talk about afterwards. But it's not crucial. It's just not big enough.
Congressman Al.
When we talk about all the places that there is war, I really think that when any countries get together to talk peacefully about problems, that's a good thing. Whether something comes out of it, for example, the one that Alan used, the spring.
Fight against the
Arab Spring.
Arab Spring. What happened was they made some decisions and then everything changed, and so their decisions kind of got blown up. But I'm all for anybody talking to anybody rather than the alternative.
Better talking than shooting.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about a development that happened over the weekend. I want to talk a little bit about Iran politics. There was an election in Iran. There was a little bit of an upset. Outsiders are looking at it very closely, and Washington's looking at it with a skeptical eye. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
You know, you hear us talk about Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., as being the place to be, America's premier cigar tavern, place to make new friends or visit old friends, or even have a lively political discussion like we do here on Backroom Politics. But what you may not know, Shelley's is the place for private parties. Shelley's Backroom is available to host events for groups of 10 to 250. From cocktail receptions to sit-down dinners, Shelley's can provide custom menu options to suit your needs and budget. Although Shelley's is a smoke-friendly environment. Shelly's can make accommodations for non-smokers based on the size of your party, but heck, why would you want to? With a cigar menu like they have here, why would you even consider going smoke-free? Event pricing varies based on the time of the day of the week chosen for your event. For more information on private parties at Shelly's Back Room, go to www.shellysbackroom.com/private-party. Shelly's Back Room, the place to be, as Bob likes to say it. It's also the place for private parties.
Congressman Al, that's Duke Ellington. The song is Janet. Great piece of music. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Backroom in Washington, D.C. We're going to talk real quickly about the election in Iran that just happened in a surprise move. We don't have to deal with Ahmadinejad anymore. Those little members-only jackets are now gone. Thank God. But now we have a new person in play. Hassan Rouhani, who's largely viewed in the global community as a moderate inside Iran. He is, the former mayor of Tehran, has now become the new Iranian president. He still has to answer to a cleric that is wielding some really impressive power. But Rouhani's got the global community kind of saying, all right, maybe we can talk with this guy. Alan Moore. We don't know a lot about this guy. We're getting news coming out and more and more intelligence about him. But is this something that we can be skeptically looking, you know, hey, there might be light at the end of the tunnel. We might be able to deal with this guy.
Well, yeah. I mean, beggars can't be choosers. And we're pleased that it's a guy who is perceived as more moderate than others. And he had a pretty convincing victory. He won 50%. There was no runoff. And that was a surprise. What it means, who knows? As you point out, there's an Ayatollah who's carries most of the cards. But we all watched Ahmadinejad be the public face often of Iran. He was frightening. He was provocative. He was disgusting. And ultimately, he also became a subject of fodder for Saturday Night Live. Never a good thing if you're trying to be a serious world leader. We're just desperate in the case of Iran of finding people we can talk to. So we once again are hopeful, but I'm hoping it's not like Lucy and Charlie Brown with the football, that one more time, Lucy puts the football down, and we think, now's our chance to kick a field goal. Oops, she snatches it away.
Congressman Al.
But I think we're a little naive if we think that every time something in another part of the world that is very different from ours moves in a moderate direction, to think that now they agree with us. I mean, Arab Spring had a lot of that. Oh, now Egypt's going to be a democracy, and now Libya's going to be a democracy. But nonsense. It's not in the culture. It's not in the history. And there are going to be different kinds of problems, and maybe they will be easier problems. I don't know, but there's going to be problems.
But, Ralph Wayne.
Yeah, and I think the Iranian people have really been suffering horribly, not only the repression, but also economically. And finally, you have this person who's supposed to be a moderate. But it's going to be very interesting to see if he will go along with supporting the UN resolutions and take a less confrontational approach in dealing with Israel and the West.
Bob Hines.
The gentleman who has won the election is only a moderate,
right,
if you look at the other six candidates.
Sure.
Who were all extreme, Khamenei, right-wing, autocratic, religious structure government that they've got. The reality is he's just a little bit to their left, and he could not have run for office if he wasn't approved by the clerics, because they're the ones who approved the slate of candidates who were allowed to run. And he was the most moderate in the view of where Iranian politics off, which is way, way over on one side of the coin. It's I would not see him as anyone who is going to make any significant changes in any of the policies, domestic or foreign, that the Ayatollahs want.
Denise Crapp.
You're right. I mean, he is definitely more moderate than the others. And the issue for the everyday person in Iran is going to be, how does this change impact my ability to feed my children? I realize I keep talking about the ability to feed your children, but when the price of bread goes up and the price of your basic food staples go up and you're not able to pay for them, then that's what you're going to be focusing on, and that's what you're going to be putting pressure on your leaders and saying, I want to feed my children, especially when the majority of the population in Iran is younger than, I believe it's 30 at this point in
right.
time. So they're not going to remember what happened in 1979. They weren't alive for
yeah,
that.
Yeah, but Denise Crapp, when we look at a possible new regime, a more moderate regime coming into the presidency, not necessarily replacing the Ayatollahs, there's still a lot of hurdles that have to be overcome before we even remotely think about, as a global community, taking back the sanctions that are impacting
and
these young
people. And that's what, right, that's what we're going to be thinking about here in the United States. But the day-to-day person in Iran is going to say, okay, well, does this mean the United States is going to lift the sanctions? I can say, think, as a mother, that's my first question. Will I be able to feed my children? And that's what they're going to ask.
But Ralph Winnie, I mean, how long do we have to look at somebody like Hussein before we look at, you know, possibly addressing the issue of retracting some of these restrictions that are against the Iranian people right now?
Well, I think the ball is in their court. Let's see what he's going to propose. I mean, if it's just the more of the same, then no, we don't lift the sanctions. But if he comes forth with genuine offers of trying to create a better political and economic situation in Iran, outreach to the West, then certainly we will work with them. But the key is it has to come from their end.
Alan Moore, when we look at the issues that are facing, I mean, this guy's taking the helm of a very unstable nuclear program in the eyes of the global community. Is nuclear the top issue that he's going to have to show some moderation on, or are there other ways he can show goodwill to the global community?
That it's all about that issue. That issue is number one, number two, number three, number 10. It is the issue. It's the whole reason that the rest of the world is sometimes harming itself by participating in these sanctions. And so that is the issue. And the question is, what will this man, what are his inclinations? What ability is he going to have to make changes? And that's where the Ayatollah really holds the trump cards.
But Al Swift, you were here in Washington during the 1979 Iranian hostage crisis. Bob Hines, same with you. When we look back at the old Iran under Ayatollah Khomeini, and we've seen the progression even into Ahmadinejad, is there a reason for us to have some hope that this guy could be the moderate that we're looking for to help us increase stability in the region?
A tiny yes, but keeping in mind that the important guy is the religious cleric, is Khomeini, and that guy hasn't shown me much reason for hope since 79.
Bob Hines, does the Ayatollah have to go before we see any sort of developments in bringing moderation to the Islamic State of Iran?
Well, I would like to say no, he can change his views, but he's been sitting there in charge for over a decade now, and his views have not changed, and I don't expect them to change. I think that it's nice that the gentleman who won the election is the most, quote, moderate, because maybe at least there'll be some voice that isn't saying, yes, yes, amen, yes, amen, you're absolutely right. I'm glad maybe, but I don't think it's going to happen.
Denise Crapp.
But I think the problem that he is going to have, the cleric, is that in 79, he could control the message. The Ayatollah Khomeini could control the message because he was in charge. He didn't have Twitter. He didn't have Facebook. He didn't have Instagram. He didn't have Pinterest. He didn't have all of these means for social media. And so they're going to have to overcome the social media, which is something that they cannot stop. You cannot shut this down like you can shut down, you know, taking away your magazine when you come into the country.
Congressman Al.
Question. Will the fact that a moderate won an election, and it was a bit of a surprise, will that have any effect at all on the clerics?
Alan Moore.
I think the answer is yes. It will have some effect. Will it change his decision-making? Will it change his behavior? We don't know. That's really the question. But this has got to be, you know, the West was surprised. I'm guessing he was also surprised, and he thought,
almost like Robert Redford in The Candidate.
The public is speaking out here. They have suffered significant deprivation because of these sanctions, and they are, in this small way, or not so small way, saying, enough. We want some change. We want some things restored to us that have not been available now for years.
Alan, are we seeing what could be the beginning of a velvet revolution inside Iran? Are we seeing a more empowered young population in the Iranian electorate?
We don't know how much power they have. As Denise accurately points out, they're now in touch with the world like they have never been before, and they had this chance to send this signal inside the country. So we'll wait and see, and we'll try to nudge. We'll have to be careful. We don't want to embrace the new guy because that will destroy his credibility. But we'll have to move delicately, step by step, and we can still be hopeful.
Rob Winnie.
What's very interesting is that the Chinese have been very active in Iran for years, not only buying the oil, but also developing infrastructure projects. They built the major subway system there. And they've indirectly had an influence in terms of connecting with the people who it's all mostly now it's about the economics and, like Denise said, being able to feed their kids. And there's an idea that the Iranian government should adopt the Chinese model, where you have the controlled, ordered system, but everyone can prosper economically. And that's going to be interesting to see how that starts to develop.
Congressman Al, your comment.
What I wanted to do is if the election might have some effect on the Ayatollah. Right. We mentioned all these new social media things that the young people understand and are using. And my question is, the Ayatollah is an old man. Does he even understand that?
Denise Kraft.
This Ayatollah may not, but the next one will. Because, you know, this one's been in power now for 10 years. The other one was in power for a good 20 years before that. So there's a lot of backroom politicking going on. Saying,
shameless plug. Nice job, Denise.
It is saying, you know, who is going to be the next one? And they're doing it now.
Bob Hines, final word.
Final word. I'm reminded of what Mr. Ronald Reagan said at one point. Trust but verify. We'll see. I think if there's any change, I expect it to be extremely slow and very, very controlled. And I'd be surprised if much happens.
Well, we're going to let that be the last word. Ralph Woody, thanks for joining us as always. Appreciate your perspective.
Enjoy being on the show.
When we come back, we're going to talk immigration. The fight gets more and more confusing, and they're looking at Boehner. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom. 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
You know, for those who listen to Backroom Politics and know about Shelley's Backroom, they think of it as some sort of cigar bar where politicians go to smoke their cigars and drink their martinis. Actually, what you don't know about Shelley's Back Room has one of the greatest menus in the city. I kid you not. You've got the campfire wings. Famous campfire wings. 1 pound of roasted, not fried, seasoned, marinated jumbo chicken rings served with their own special honey mustard sauce. Folks, if you like chicken wings, you've never had the campfire wings. Best wings in the city, bar none, I guarantee. If you don't like it, Al, you can call us up and tell us that you don't like it. You have daily specials. Come down on a day when they have the Justin Chicken Sandwich, the sandwich named after me, breaded chicken breast, provolone cheese, thick-cut bacon on a Kaiser roll served with a honey mustard sauce. Folks, it doesn't get more artery-clogging than that, but it is worth it. Come down to Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., the premier sponsor of Backroom Politics.
Back here live at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics Live. I'm your moderator, Justin Russell. And the Backroom Politics here gang is here talking about immigration. The immigration question continues to boggle the minds of Congress, and it gets more and more interesting every day. Hey, when we look at what's happening lately, Speaker John Boehner now has got the big target on him. Bob Hines, Speaker Boehner, saying there's not a real chance that we're going to see any immigration bill that can obviously pass through the House. We're also seeing a situation where a lot of the pressure is going on the Speaker to get this passed and get it through and get it as showing a sign of, hey, we can function. How much pressure is actually on the Speaker right now?
Well, there's a lot of pressure, generally speaking, particularly from the Tea Party people. I think that and one of the reasons the House has not yet developed the bill fully is because I think they're holding back. I think, and I wouldn't be surprised if the Speaker wasn't saying, let's wait a little bit. I think the fundamental issue is right now is border security. That's the problem the Senate has. I think it's the main problem that the House has, at least as in a sense of the issues they're talking about. And I don't expect to see it come to any fruition until well after the Senate moves. And if the Senate moves, I think the House will probably find a way to do something. But I don't know what that is at this stage.
But Congressman Al, Politico is reporting in a great story by Rebecca Elliott that Congressman Rohrabacher out of California, Republican, has pretty much called his speakership into question, saying that you allow this to come to the floor or even remotely pass, your speakership is in jeopardy. Have you seen that kind of tactic coming from a member of your own caucus before?
I've seen things like that from Rohrabacher before.
There were some examples of a little rebellion in the ranks with Speaker Foley and some others. It happens occasionally. But Rohrabacher carries weight on the right. He doesn't carry weight with any of the moderates. So to the extent that the Republicans have some tendencies toward moderation, Rohrabacher isn't going to have a lot of influence with that.
Alan Moore,
Well, what my understanding, my take on what Robach has done, is that he was responding to the speaker's comments in the recent days that immigration is a high priority and we want to move this issue. And then Rohrabacher came back and said, if you move this issue without a majority of Republicans supporting it, your leadership would be at risk. And Boehner this afternoon said, we want a majority of Republicans to support this bill. So I don't see a lot of news yet on this front. He says it's a priority, and he wants a majority of Republicans to support it. The Senate is engaged, moving forward. If the Senate is trying to finish this up before they leave at the end of next week to go out for a week or 10 days over the 4th of July, the House won't act before that, but there is a group of people in the House that's wrestling with some of this stuff. They can pass a bill that would look very different from the Senate bill. I'm not saying they will, but they could. And ultimately, this is going to have to be sorted out, assuming the House is able to pass a bill in a conference. And then that will be the really interesting one because the question for Boehner will be, in a compromise bill with the Senate, can I get a majority, and how will he handle that? But we're a long way away from that.
Carl Tooven.
The interesting thing is that this is one area where a few Democrats and a few Republicans in the House have been talking for weeks and trying to bank something out. Congressman Ballard was on TV a couple of days ago talking about this. The congressman from
Florida.
He's from Florida, the one from San Antonio, the Democrat.
Castro.
Castro has taken the leadership, among others, on this whole thing. So it's kind of a real disappointment for him to say no. And I think it's going to have repercussions.
Congressman Al.
Rohrabacher's warning to the speaker only looks at half of the speaker's problem. The other half is the Republicans have to maintain the House for him to maintain the speakership. And if they mishandle immigration, it is entirely possible that could put the Republican majority in jeopardy, because the Hispanics and their friends, which would be a lot of other minorities and what have you, may just rise up and say, you don't care about us, and so we don't care about you.
But Alan Moore, Rohrabacher is just one voice that we're hearing, and it's getting a lot of attention, but it seems like he is describing a sense in the House of House Republicans that this is going to be a major theme inside the caucus. Does that put the Senate bill at danger right now?
The Senate bill is the Senate bill. They're not paying attention to the House. They're just trying to get a bill through the Senate that has 60 votes. They could care less at the moment about the House and the Speaker's problems. But eventually, the Speaker will have to... I mean, this is a decision he's had to confront several times now. Will he bring a bill before the House that does not have a majority of the majority, that doesn't have at least 50% plus one of the Republicans? That is a challenge. I did want to say something about Al's comment. It is certainly true that this immigration issue is important to a fair number of Americans, including a fair number of Hispanics, but I've seen some poll data about the issues that Hispanics care the most about. This is not it. They care the most about the same issues that all Americans care about, which is economy, jobs, education, health care. That doesn't mean you could ignore the immigration issue, or that you can say it doesn't matter or keep them out, but as has been pointed out, where different families are or groups are on this issue depends on where they are in the society, what their standing is. Are you harboring, hiding, concealing, worrying about relatives? Or are you saying, wait a minute, these people are going to take my job? It's not a simple black and white issue for Hispanics any more than it is for everybody else. even though it is more important writ large for Hispanics.
Well, and I, for now.
I agree with you. I am just saying that I think some Republicans should have their head examined for going down this road. And I start with Pete Wilson, who was governor of California, who kind of teed up this whole thing a number of years ago. Why in the world would you want to take an ethnic group that is essentially conservative and insult it, abuse it, and treat it the way they're treating these issues? It just seems to be crazy politics on the part of the Republicans.
Bob Hines.
You saw the way, you know, as you say, the governor of California teed it up, and he hit the ball in the ocean. He did nothing. He blew his own career. I mean, it's an issue that is, I think Alan is right. On a day-to-day conversation basis, most Hispanics are thinking about the same issues everybody else is thinking about.
But as
an issue that unites an awful lot of people about saying, hey, we got to fix this problem. This is unfair the way it is. It's an emotional issue, which I think will have a significant impact. The way it's handled by the Republican Party, it's going to have a very significant impact upon how successful the party is in future years.
But Alan Moore, when we look at the immigration question, particularly right now with Harry Reid announcing today he's threatening to file a cloture motion to get a vote on this bill, one of the big losers, it seems, in this deal seems to be Marco Rubio, one of the key components of the Gang of Eight. He's taking hits of, he's an insider, he's playing Beltway politics with an immigration issue that's much broader. Is he really at risk right now of being a rising star in the party, or is this something he can escape?
You know, it's a good question, and I don't think any of us know the answer yet. He has got to be really careful. He was a darling of the right. He had pulled off a big upset in Florida. He's still something of a darling. He's shown some courage to involve himself so deeply into this issue because it is not a risk-free matter. It is not risk-free in Florida, and it is not risk-free among conservative Republicans. Having said that, he's an attractive, smart, clever guy. It's too soon for us to know whether this was a risk worth taking or not.
Carl Toobin.
I think on his part, he believes in this, and it's a gamble. If the Senate passes the bill, and he has said he likes 95% of the bill, and if he votes for it, he becomes, I think, a bigger person than he has been, and maybe, and you know, you can do things. People get angry at you, but if you're popular and if you're good, they're going to come back.
But Bob Hines, when we look at this going to the House, and eventually it looks like Harry Reid's got enough votes in the House to get this, you know, in the Senate to get it over to the House. This thing goes to the House, we're talking about a whole new front on a whole new war. With immigration being such a huge priority domestically, on the domestic side, can politics really survive the pressure of the electorate to get something passed, get something definitive, and get it through what is looked at as a logjam in the House, particularly with Rohrabacher's comments?
Well, if the Senate is able to pass a bill with 60-plus votes, I think the biggest test is, the biggest looks like stop point right now is the amendment by John Cornyn, the deputy leader in the Senate for the Republicans,
right,
whose border security legislation proposal,
right,
is seen as a little step too far as far as a lot of the people who support the bill are. And Rubio, and I will now ruin tell me a story. Rubio is working very hard, a little bit outside the Gang of Eight, still a part of it, trying to work to find, working with Cornyn, trying to find a way to soften or broaden, amend his approach, Cornyn's approach, in order that he can get, that Cornyn can support the bill, and that will push it over in the Senate. And Rubio is on extremely difficult position because he's a little bit outside his group of eight. And at the same time, he is working with somebody who has not been friendly, and he's trying to solve the problem. It's a very dicey situation right now for him. And as Carl said, if this thing all works out well, he could become an extremely popular fellow with an awful lot of voters.
And but not inside the base.
No,
though.
And if it doesn't work out and he implodes, it could be a big crimp on a very interesting career.
So then all of a sudden now, Alan Moore, we go back to Speaker Boehner. Does he invoke the Hastert rule on this? Or can he?
Well, he said today that he will. So, you know, we don't know what the House has done yet. Or, excuse me, we don't have a Senate bill yet. If Reid talks about invoking cloture, he's got to be careful because he can anger Republicans who say, wait a minute, you violated our understanding, which is we get as many amendments as we want, and he, Reid, has stepped in front of a particular amendment saying he thinks it's a deal killer, that it's designed to be a poison pill, as it were. And that's a big problem for him, but also for Republicans, because the deal was, we'll let this bill come up with the understanding that we get all the amendments that we want. That doesn't mean hundreds of amendments, but it means
within reason.
Some of these difficult amendments. And if he's jumping in front to try to head off dealing with, I think it's the Cornyn, but Cornyn is a moving target. They modify the language on border security, and the whole question is, and we talked about it a little bit last week, what do you have to do in strengthening border security before these other things, the rights to the pathway to citizenship will occur? It's complicated. There's lots of differences of opinion. There's lots of ways to solve this, but the focus is still on the Senate. The House and the Speaker's problems will emerge soon enough, and the exchange in the last day or two is just a reminder of how complicated his life is.
But Bob Hines, when we look even on both sides, even in the Senate, you know, we've got people like Kelly Ayotte who says she will support the immigration bill. We have Marco Rubio, part of the Gang of Eight that brought the immigration bill to fruition. Are we starting to see now a more moderate sector of the Republican Party getting more and more visibility in people like Ayotte and people like Rubio?
Well, yes, you're seeing more of them because they are becoming spokespersons in some extent with respect with the immigration bill. They're becoming part of the structure that's putting it together. So you're seeing them more often. Maybe then you're seeing some of the more conservative people in the Senate on the Republican side, but that doesn't change the voting. That doesn't change the voting system at this point. I mean, there's still a majority of the Republicans who have great skeptical that they can vote for a bill. They want to see more border strengthening at a very minimum, and I'm not sure what they might want beyond that. But you're listening more to the. Moderates, because they're the ones who are out talking about the importance of the bill and how the bill does a number of reasonable things and doesn't just let everybody get in and become a citizen tomorrow. It's a 13-year run to become a citizen is a long time. It's not as though the bill says, come on in, you're a citizen tomorrow. And it's a pretty reasonable bill, but it's still got a long way to go.
But hearing a lot of the Tea Party Republicans talking on the House side, Alan, understanding the fact we still don't have a bill going over to the other side, we're still hearing that's a lot of money to be putting towards an immigration bill, particularly in a time we've got sequestration and we've got to take certain financial controls.
When the Tea Party has to start talking about the money, that means the other side is beginning to win here, because first of all, these numbers are all subject to lots of challenge. This is really about the concepts, the so-called notion of amnesty, of giving something to people who broke the law. That's the heart of it. And then with an underpinning that is appealing to a lot of people of presumably some level of racism that shows up in some places, hard to know. It's got to just play itself out. And there's no bill that everybody's going to like. There was talk in the Senate just a week or so ago that we're trying to get a bill that has a big majority, not just the 60 threshold, but 70 or so votes. And then a couple of days ago, Dick Durbin, the deputy leader on the Democratic side, said 60 is our target. So they all know this is tough, but they know also that there's going to be people who vehemently oppose anything, and sometimes that'll be because that's how they believe, how they feel, and some of it will be matched to the politics of their particular situations. That's how it works.
Call Toobin.
There was one report I heard, Alan, that somebody said if the Senate produces 70 votes for the bill, then the House would have to do something.
Do you agree with that, Alan Moore?
The House will do something if it wants to do something, but it really has to. It really has to do with where Boehner, where this bipartisan group are, where Boehner thinks his people are. If you have 70 votes, though, it's not the number that's important. It's the fact that that means a lot of Republicans came over and voted for it. So it's what the number symbolizes, not the number itself.
Bob Hines,
that is a key. Alan said it exactly right. The larger the number in the Senate, the more likely it is that in the House there'll be legislation that will move to the floor very, very much more easily than otherwise. The closer the vote is in the Senate, the more difficult it becomes, because the more Tea Party type folks in the House decide they can step aside and not vote for it. So obviously, with Mr. Durbin, saying 60, I think he's trying to, dampen down enthusiasms, but I'll make you bet he's still working on his on colleagues that he knows on both sides of the aisle to make sure they're going to vote.
I want to go back to something that Alan said, though. Bob Hines, I'm going to go to you on this. When we look at, the question of this is a racism issue, we don't like Mexicans. We talked about this last week, but we see somebody like Ted Cruz out of Texas saying, look, this immigration bill does not work. Is that type of Republican the type of Republican we're going to see it saying, this is, are they displacing the idea that this is not a racist issue?
I certainly hope that Senator Cruz is in the great, great, great minority here, because he is a pain in the ass, pardon my French. He's just wrong, flat out wrong. The Republican Party does not need to make any more voters angry at them than they have already. And I don't mean that we should just, take our view from what the liberal Democrats want. But the reality is, we need to do something to settle the question of immigration and 11 million illegal citizen people in this country, most of whom want to be citizens, and they're good people and they're working people.
Carl Toobin.
Senator Cruz is now more popular in Texas than Rick Perry is, and I think he is trying to talk to his Texas base, his fundraisers, and that. I think that's what he's doing.
Alan Moore.
We do a disservice to people if we try to categorize them as purely political, racist, principled. This is a complicated issue. There are legitimate questions of principle on all sides. We did a major immigration reform bill in the early 1980s. Lots of backslapping, self-congratulatory messages, and people continue to flood across. And there's legitimate concern that what we do now is rewarding those very people that we thought in the early 80s we were going to keep out. That's not a, that's not racist or illegitimate in its, on its face or in its own right. Having said that, I am perfectly willing to believe that in the way that people's minds work, the complicating aspects of what we do, what we think, how we talk, how we act, etc., that there is in some places with some people some element of racism, but I think it would be a disservice and unfair for us to say it's all about racism. It's all about whatever it is for individual members, and there are, and there are people who are worried that even though they might feel themselves in one particular way, if the politics are so powerful to push them to another side, they will do that. It varies all over the country. There are huge regional differences, it's hard, it's complicated, and there is this underlying fairness question, and you know, the unions are fit to be tied about what to do about this. They're
on board with the Chamber of Commerce.
They are on board, but without enthusiasm, and there are divisions among the unions about whether union jobs are going to be at risk. I mean, there's, you pick a group, and you'll find challenges that they're wrestling with of all sorts. I think we just have to be careful of, and not characterize people as having a particular narrow point of view simply because that's one of the issues that's part of
Congressman, now, are we going to see that immigration is going to be the one that maybe divides the Republican Party? We're seeing a little bit in the Senate. We're definitely going to see it in the House. Is this the subject that's going to make the GOP as a whole go, wait a minute, we got to step back and reevaluate?
I think we have to see whether there are going to be some Republicans in the House who are willing to take an unpopular vote on principle. If there are enough of them to join the Democrats so they can pass it, then I think they probably, it will pass, and they will save the Republican Party.
Does it take Marco Rubio falling on his own sword to do it?
It might. It could be. You know, Senator Jackson used to say that you can take one or two major issues and vote opposite of your constituency. No more than that. Because that's the only one, that's the number that you can actually get out and talk to your constituents about those two unpopular votes. If you have three or four or five, you're swamped. If Rubio, whose voting record I think otherwise should be fairly satisfactory to his constituency, can...
Into the party.
Into the party. If he can keep that base and explain why he did this convincingly... He could possibly do that, be a hero, and survive.
Well, that's a Democratic perspective. I'm going to go to a Republican perspective. Bob Hines, does it take Marco Rubio falling on his sword?
I don't know that it takes him to fall on his sword, but I see Mr. Rubio as genuinely trying to solve this problem that he sees as an Hispanic himself. And he's trying to do it, and he is working, I guess, just about as hard. Probably no one has worked harder on this issue, I would say, in the last 6 or 8 months. And I think he's to be, credited for that, because he is obviously doing something that a lot of Republicans are not eager to do. He's doing the right thing, I think. And let us hope that, a man who is as dedicated to trying to solve the problem isn't destroyed because he tried to fix the problem.
Cloture being somewhat imminent aside, Carl Tubin, does the immigration bill pass the Senate?
Yes.
Yeah.
Alan Moore?
I think so, yeah.
Bob Hines?
Yes.
Al Swift?
Yes.
Correct answer is yes. All right, when we come back, it's our free-for-all, the last half hour here on Backroom Politics, where we talk about anything that comes up and tell me a story. We'll be back in 3 minutes. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us. Everybody knows Shelley's Backroom for its
corporate events, it's happy hours, it's famous campfire wings and fruit cigars and drinks. But what you didn't know is that Shelley's is open during the weekend, too. In fact, Shelley's Back Room on the weekends even has a non-smoking section. You can bring your family, your kids, enjoy the same campfire wings and same glorious food that you enjoy during the week, but without the famous Shelley's cigar environment. Also, during the weekend, it's football season. That means a lot of the regulars come down and enjoy their drinks and their favorite cigars, all while watching their favorite local teams, whether it's the Ravens, the Redskins, on several HD screens throughout the place. So remember, Shelley's Back Room, it's not just for happy hours anymore. 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., official sponsor of Backroom Politics.
Talk with all by myself. No one to walk with, but I'm happy on the elevation, on the shelf. Ain't misbehaving. Saving my love for you, and you, especially you, yeah. I know for certain the one I love. I'm through with flirting, it's you that I'm thinking of. Ain't misbehaving, saving all my love for you. Like Jack Horner in a corner, don't go nowhere, what do I care? Your kisses are worth waiting for. Believe me, I don't stay out late, no place to go. I'm home about 8 at my little radio. Ain't misbehaving, saving my love for you, for you, for you, yes, you. All my love for you. Yes, that's what I'm talking about.
And we're back here live in Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington.
I think we've said that several
times. We're on Blog Talk Radio. Hey, it's our last half hour. We've already had our drink, our cigars. We get to talk about anything that comes to mind. The thing that's coming to mind with me is, so you're Robert Kraft. You're the owner of the Patriots. You meet Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia. You show him a Super Bowl ring. The president of Russia takes the Super Bowl ring. FSB agents circle you. The president of Russia walks off with your ring. How bizarre is this, Alan?
Well, it reminded me once when I was the staff director of the Senate Commerce Committee, and Bart Starr, the famous Green Bay Packers quarterback, was in the office for some reason. I don't remember the issue. Might have been the expansion of the NFL or something. That was an issue back then. And he was wearing a big Super Bowl ring. Now, it wasn't this humongous Buick.
Jewel-encrusted
Buick on your finger that they make now. It was just a small little Volkswagen. It was a big old ring, and he was not that big a man. And I said, "Wow, is that your ring? Can I try it on?" And he handed it over, and I put it on. And I'm trying to imagine me then putting it in my pocket. First of all, he would have kicked my ass right on the spot. It was just not going to happen. So I'm trying to imagine how this thing happened, and Kraft must have thought, this is all in jest, and gee, I don't want to create an international incident. What I don't understand, though, is how when they walked out, the next thing that apparently occurred was he sent a little note to Putin, no doubt with the encouragement of the U.S. government, and he has said as much, saying, you know, I thought you might like that as a souvenir and as a symbol of our friendship. Well, this was years ago this happened, and then just the other day he starts talking about this, saying, Putin stole my ring. Well, the ring is on display, apparently, at the Moscow Library, sort of this thing, and the Russians seem to me to have a bit of an argument, saying, well, wait a minute, you gave it to him. We didn't steal anything, we gave it to him. It's really strange, but really kind of fun and funny.
It is funny. So, Bob, you're working the Russian desk at State Department in Foggy Bottom. Do you just go, oh, crap? Or do you just let it go and say, Mr. Kraft, thank you, God bless you? and you get a night in the White House.
Now, what I say is, Mr. Kraft, why don't you talk to the commissioner and have him authorize another ring? That's what I do.
Wow, you are, wow. I was hoping you'd go something big. You give me nothing, man. Nothing.
Hey. That's okay.
I expect that from Congressman Al, for crying out
Listen,
loud.
Listen, this is not something they should even be discussing. It's a,
why not? No, this is an inter.
I don't
this
mean
is an international
I don't
incident.
Mean,
we're talking about the New England Patriots here, Robert.
I know, and I think that
America's team.
Oh, come on now. That's never going to be true.
So you say, Carl Dubin.
Two things. First of all, the Patriots, if there are ever any exhibition games in Moscow, the Patriots probably will not be invited, number one.
What are you talking about? Are you kidding? Putin's got a Super Bowl ring.
Number two, I want to find out, or I want to do some research and find out whether Kraft is a Democrat or a Republican.
Are you really thinking there's political spin in this?
No. There could be political spin in everything. Who knows?
Carl, you could be the ultimate political conspirator, man.
Carl, go do the research. Don't tell us what you're going to do.
Do it. I will. Find out. Yeah, and I'm the one with the computer.
But in terms of Bob's suggestion, I think that's exactly what Kraft has done. He said, "Look, I'll get you a copy, but that one was mine. It's got my name engraved in it. It means something special to me. We'll get you one. These things cost probably $25,000.
Yeah.
I mean, they're filled with diamonds.
I know.
What I don't get is why out of the blue, after all these years and after a note saying it's yours,
hey, enjoy.
Suddenly he's out talking about it in some private event, and now it's in the news and we're talking about it.
Congressman Al.
But he'd be the only guy who ever got two of those. I think that would be.
He's the owner. He's buying them.
Good point.
He can buy all that he wants.
You don't need to be authorized by the commissioner.
Well, I don't know. I don't know about that. I have no idea. But the point is, he can get another one.
Right.
And he can send you this one. And he sent this one to Pooh. Say, you send me the one with my name in it, I'll send you this, and I'll send you this one.
This is the kind of thing that should have been public.
We have to announce this on the air. Ladies and gentlemen, the chairman of the GOP of D.C., Ron Phillips, has joined us. Hello, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Yeah, there you go. See? I've earned my keep today. Hey, the other thing that keeps coming up is, now, all of a sudden, PRISM, the NSA supercomputer, save the world, turn poop into cinnamon rolls computer, is now back in the spotlight. You've got the head of the NSA now talking about how PRISM stopped Times Square, stock exchange attack, etc. This is a story that keeps on giving. Bob Hines, is this thing really going to have a lot of legs as we go down into an election cycle, whether it's midterm or into 2016?
Well, I guess it, to some degree, it depends if there are new informations that come out that titillate, if you will. It sounds to me like we've heard an awful lot from NSA leadership, the national security guy, Clipper, what's his name? Clipper. So there's been a number of senior members who have never wanted to testify, but they have come before Congress and they have spoken very openly about what the program is and what it does and what it has done. Now, it seems to me that when you have a situation where one administration, which is of one party, adopts it after a major problem, the other party, the Democrats, reauthorize it and extend it when they're in power, that means that the Congress twice has had a chance to take a hard look at this, when it's sometime it was Republican control, sometime Democrat, and it's approved it. Seems to me the program is a good program. There are probably, I'm sure, a lot of people who wish it hadn't come out. Now it has, if for no other, and I think maybe in some sense, the American people seem to be comfortable with a program as they understand it today. that in effect all the telephone calls and this stuff isn't being read, I mean, or being heard. It's just a matter of who's talking to who and things like that. And then you got to go farther to the court to get anything else of what information. So it seems to me that it's not that big a story going forward.
But, Alan Moore, it looks like Obama doesn't know which way to kind of pivot on this subject. He's on Charlie Rose saying, I'm no Dick Cheney, but he's also on Charlie Rose saying, hey, wait a minute, I'm using that Bush stuff. That stuff's cool. Can he win in this argument right now?
He's having trouble winning here because he was Mr. Transparency and Mr. What is this non-permissive invasion of privacy? And it turns out that he's not been transparent and that he's got a program, partly because of technology, that's far bigger than what Bush was doing, simply because the technology now allows it. What's really painful for the intelligence community and national security community is that now the world is kind of in on some of what we were doing, and we start talking about how now 50 different terrorism plots were thwarted because of the use of this program.
And also, by the way, it's not just us. GCHQ, the British equivalent of NSA, well, they've been doing it too.
They've identified a few examples, but the more examples they identify, and they don't want to identify them, is more clues to what exactly they were getting and what they were looking at. In the meantime, all of Silicon Valley, because people conflate, they think every phone call and every email is somehow in this massive system. Not true. Every phone call is in the system, but it's a phone call, it's information, the metadata about what phone number called what other phone number for how long on what date. That's what we've got. There's no content involved. In terms of all of the email, the Gmail, the Facebook, all the internet stuff, that is simply an acknowledgement of our ability to ask for specific information. And some of these firms, Apple, Facebook, to name two, have said, we have fielded a few thousand requests under court order in the last several years out of, in effect, billions and billions of communications. But every time that we're asked, it has to be very specific. It has to be under a court order. And now as we slowly absorb all of this, it doesn't seem so massive, which doesn't mean there won't be people yelling and screaming and throwing out charges. James Clapper, the director of national intelligence, who is being accused of lying, and he did use just wrong words to describe what happened, and he is still going to be on the hot seat.
Congressman Al.
I think that the American people have grown up a lot since the days of Gary Powell. Remember him?
Yeah, the U-2 pilot.
Yeah.
Shot down over Russia.
I was in high school, and
I wasn't born.
Daddy Eisenhower, you know, everybody's father figure, was responsible for it, and it was very embarrassing to the administration. There was a lot of explanation. We were spying. Was the United States spying? Do we spy? You know, that was kind of the national reaction. You're not getting that now.
Right.
We're much more sophisticated about what's necessary and what we're doing, and so forth. So I think that this will, first of all, the administration, whom we love on this program to say what they're doing wrong, I think that the intelligence agencies have been making very strong, good points about what they're doing. They're not BSing anybody. They're laying it out and they're defending it on rational terms. And I think the American public will hear that. I think there is a problem here that is best examined by committees of Congress that are kind of sworn to secrecy, the Security Committee, what have you, because this could get out of control. I don't see any evidence that it is yet out of control, and we want to be sure that there are things in place to keep it from getting out of control. But I don't think this is going to be something that's going to keep most Americans awake at night in the long run.
Congressman Al, while I've got you on the microphone here, one of the things that happened last week, kind of a Page Six side item. For those of you out there who don't know what Page Six is, it's kind of a tabloid portion of the New York Post, which is a tabloid into itself. But on a Page Six note, Michelle Bachmann's not running for re-election. Is Washington, D.C. going to miss Michelle Bachmann? Congressman Al.
The cartoonists will. Saturday Night Live will. A bunch of people like that will. The ultra-right wing of the party will. But she won't, because she's going to make a lot of money. I mean, she watched the former governor of Alaska, and she said, that's the way to go. She obviously had nowhere up to go. Her career in Congress was killed, and so she's going to go off and make money.
And Carl Toobin.
Well, you know, we might lose Michelle Bachmann, but we're going to get Sarah Palin back. Evidently, she's
back on Fox.
She's back on Fox. So,
amazing.
So, you know, you're going to have that going on over again.
She's not the problem. Fox is the problem.
Alan, are we going to miss Michelle Bachmann in Washington?
You know, I talked about the 10th anniversary of PEPFAR earlier. I'm thinking that we will miss Michelle Bachmann like we will miss a sexually transmitted infection.
It's a family show.
He never said a bad word.
It's a family show.
Said sexual.
Sexual.
How do you think families come about?
Yes.
You know, If I had said STI, you guys, some people around this table would have said, "What's that?"
Yeah. Are you looking at me when you said that?
Just make it a statement.
Because you probably know.
I do know.
Carl's an innocent.
I'm getting. Show. And by the way, I'm getting some weird looks from the sidelines right now. Hey. Also, you know what we didn't talk about today is we didn't talk about Joe Biden had another biweekly Joe Biden gun summit where he talked about the success of gun control. Yet we still don't see a gun control bill. Congressman Al, how does Joe Biden claim success in gun control when we don't have a gun control bill?
Because he's Joe Biden.
Good point. Enough said. Alan Moore?
Al said it all. But, this issue isn't done.
No.
And Biden is a believer. So, and Joe Manchin from West Virginia, who put his neck out on the line with his NRA followers and voters, is now getting ready to go on the air and talk about background checks and why he thinks they're important. So, I think people like Kelly out who got hammered and could easily get hammered again, they were all great beneficiaries of the double shitstorm sandwich that hit the
Again,
White House.
Again, family show. My God.
With all the scandals, because it pushed gun background checks into the background, but it'll come back. And Joe Biden will be one of those who helped make it.
I wish to point out
that I am probably, among this whole group, I am probably the person that is the most foul-mouthed and indiscreet member.
Hear, hear.
I'll agree with that.
My reputation is being destroyed largely by Alan, but also by Bob.
Well, Bob drops one F-bomb, forget it.
And hey. Others. You know, I'm not even in this game anymore. You know,
Carl Toobin.
I think Joe Biden is trying to keep this issue alive, and he's doing it. His state of Delaware passed a bill which has background checks, and Beau Biden was on TV last night, or the night before, talking about what they did in Delaware. So I think all this is precursor to bringing the bill back up. And Manchin is fighting it. They're all fighting it, and they're all trying to convince others.
Bob Hines.
I think the Senate's going to have the bill on the floor probably I don't think it'd be before the recess, but I'll make you a bet it comes up before
the gun bill comes up for a vote again.
Yeah, I think it comes up before they get to debt ceiling and budget, because that'll blow everything.
Just out of curiosity.
And it'll pass.
Yes, it will.
Okay, first of all, you're supposed to be drinking water. You're cut off. Bob Hines, when did they stop making moonshine in red colors? You're cut off. You're both drunk.
Oh, my God.
Don't take the bet, because you'll win and they'll never pay.
Listen, let us all the people he called drunks, remove him.
That's right.
Yes.
Can't do it. My show. Hey,
well, we leave it as no show.
I'll do this solo, damn it. Oh, crap. I said something bad about
it. There we go.
Gosh darn it. Gosh darn it. Hey,
it worked, guys.
Congressman Al.
I want to change the subject, and maybe this is starting.
Let me enter into our.
Do it.
This is the part of the show. We got 10 minutes left. This is the part of our show called Tell Me a Story, where we talk about the buzz, innuendo, rumor going around. Hopefully, we scoop some of the major news organizations, or sometimes just a shameless plug or reminiscing. But this is Tell Me a Story. Congressman Al, tell me a story.
When I was elected, I was wondering if there would be any giants left in Congress. I grew up with Sam Rayburn and names like that, and I didn't know. Little did I realize that by the time my political career ended, I would be a friend, a true friend of one of the real giants, who was honored last Thursday. In a ceremony in the Statuary Hall in the Capitol. His name is John Dingell, and he was honored because he has served longer than any other member of Congress ever in the history of the Congress. And his reputation is not based on just having survived that long, but having been a very great congressman. Who do I quote on that? Well, the fellow that replaced him when the Republicans took over as chairman of the committee has publicly said that John Dingell was one of the 10 greatest congressmen in the United States. And he said, I don't mean just now. I mean in history. Thursday, they not only honored him, but the reason I'm bringing this up is because it was done with such grace by the Republicans. At a time when Republicans and Democrats have very little respect for each other, apparently, at least with some of the people. The speaker was gracious beyond belief in introducing him. The vice president spoke, and so forth and so on. The fact is that it was announced that the room in which John Dingell has operated as chairman and as ranking member for virtually all of the 50-some years he's been in Congress, room 23 in Rayburn Building, is being named the John D. Dingell Room. Who proposed that? Joe Barton, who was the fellow who became chairman of the committee when the Republicans took over, and Fred Upton, who is the current Republican chairman of the committee. Those two Republicans posed this to the speaker, who's a Republican, and they all agreed that it should be done. And after the service, I approached both of them and told them I thought it was an enormously gracious thing for them to do, and Joe Barton said, I wanted to do it when I was chairman of the committee, and then they had the election and the Democrats took over and I didn't get a chance. So he said, I jumped up. It was, Dingell spoke and talked very graciously about the Congress and about the Republicans, expressing the need for there to be more collegial activity than there was, but he didn't do an attack on the Tea Party or anything. He just said that we kind of got out of kilter here and we need to get back to it. It was a remarkable example of how Congress used to work and still can if it is given the opportunity and the right leadership. And in this case, the leadership was
Baker and Joe Barton, who was about as conservative as you can get in the old terms of what conservative meant, and Fred Upton, who's a little more moderate, but still a Republican. I was proud and privileged to be there, but I was just so amazed at how honest the graciousness of the speaker and the Republicans were in that instance in honoring John. And I know I've gone on too long, but with a little prompt, I could start telling John Dingell stories.
No, we'll do that when we have Congressman Dingell on. No, well deserved, no question about it. Proof positive that, hey, we can get along, we can do work together. Bob Hines, tell me a story. 5 minutes left.
I am not. We've already talked enough about the immigration and the effort of Mr. Senator Rubio, who I think is showing great courage in what he's doing and trying to solve a problem, which is a difficult one, and he's working very hard. And he's a lover. The Tea Party loves him, but he's doing things that maybe they don't love, but he's doing the right thing. But I want to follow up on something with what John said. I'll be quick. As a Republican who dealt constantly when I was working with NBC, with the Commerce Committee, with Al Swift, my dear partner here, and with John Dingell, I have to say and repeat everything Al said. John Dingell is one of the greatest legislators, I think, in the history of the United States Congress. He found ways to get things done that were fantastic. He did things that were difficult. He was fair. He was honest. He was open. I don't think I ever had a time when I dealt with Dingell that I didn't think he was doing everything exactly the way it should be done. And I didn't always get everything I wanted, and I certainly didn't deserve it sometimes. But I was still asking for it, and John did everything he could to be helpful and to find a solution to the problems that I brought to him. And I admire the man before almost any member of Congress I have ever worked with.
Still want him on the show. Would love to do that interview. Alan Moore, 3 minutes left. Tell me a story.
Yeah, so with all of this stuff that's going on in the White House, one wonders, has anybody won anything out of all of this? Well, only people who were involved in some kind of a disastrous scandal. And right here in the Washington, D.C. area, we have got various candidates. We got Governor McConnell of Virginia, who it turns out McDonald from Virginia, who has had a very cozy relationship with some of his supporters and financiers, and who came up with a $15,000 gift to his daughter to pay for the catering at her wedding, and has taken the gifts of vacations, and even put some small household expenses onto the governor's account. Disastrous stuff for him and any potential future he may have. Not clear that it violates the law in Virginia, which suggests that the law is an ass in Virginia. In the same time, across the river in Maryland, we got Governor O'Malley. The latest huge scandal for Maryland, and to some extent for the governor, is that the disaster in the jail in Baltimore, where the criminals were in charge. And the best way to think about this is that the single one guy who was most in charge impregnated not one guard, not two guards, not three guards. He impregnated four female guards inside the prison.
Carl Dubin saying it sounds sick.
Well, maybe it's more, but it's like, what could you possibly be talking about? And this is not a brand new issue. Finally, here in the D.C. area, you've got the D.C. Council of Shame.
Three members
who have been charged with felonies and cut deals and are no longer in the council. And Marion Barry, the gift that keeps on giving, who took $7,000 in cash, reported it on his form and won't answer questions. We got big problems here locally. When we're talking about all the great stuff state and local governments are going to do, let's remember they're not always on the top of their game.
Carl Tugan, a minute left.
Real quick. There was when Putin and and the president came out and had a press conference. The president said, talked about Putin's sports stuff, and he said, my basketball is declining. And Putin looked up and said, I think he's trying to make me relax. And I that little interchange, I think, shows not Cold War coming back like some people have suggested, but maybe there's a little spark there that could grow into something positive.
Now, on the, well, all I know is Treasury is now displaying the new Jack Lew signature. I want a Jack Lew original. They're really neat. Scribbly, little circles. I want a Jack Lew original. On behalf of Congressman Al, Bob Hines, Denise Krepp, Alan Moore, and Carl Tubin, I'm your moderator, Justin Russell. We'll see you next week. Have a great week, Washington. Bye-bye.